Hey, this is April, host of Switchblade Sisters, popping in before the episode to talk to you a little bit about Max Fund Drive. We are in our third week of fundraising. First off, I want to thank you for all of your support, all of your telling your friends to listen to our show. That's so wonderful. But also, we've heard from a lot of people that there's, so much bonus content that it's keeping them so happy and so busy during all of these darker days. And so I would like to remind you that we do have some bonus content for you to listen to. If you are a member joining at the $5 level or above, and ours includes Joelle Monique, Emily Vanderwerf, and Drea Clark, all talking about Murder, She Wrote and dissecting one of my favorite episodes, and you cannot miss it. And that's available for you when you join. So you can become a member easily at MaximumFun.org/join. Choose the amount that fits within your monthly budget. It could be $5 a month, it could be $10 a month, or maybe $20 a month, whatever you want, maybe more. And whatever level you choose, your support combined with all the other Max Fund members that are just like you, coming in to make sure that we get to keep making our shows, we just appreciate you. Every little bit counts. And again, go to MaximumFun.org/join to sign up and then see all the cool gifts available in thanks for your support. Now to our show. Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that has influenced their own work in some small way. And as you may already know, we are remote recording now, so audio is going to be a little bit different. I'm in my bedroom. The cats are playing today, so Chicken and Zoli are a little frisky. Audio is just going to be a little different from our studio. Everything else is the same, except for we have got two guests today. I'm very excited to have EP director-writer Mel Eslin and then EP director Sydney Fleischman here. Hi, guys.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for having us. Yeah.
So let me give a little introduction to both of you and your work through a bio, this is your life type of thing. Mel Eslin is a film and television producer, writer and director, and president of Duplass Brothers Productions. On the small screen, she produced HBO's doc series On Tour with Asperger's Are Us, and frequently writes and directs for HBO's Room 104, on which she also serves as executive producer. Winner of the 2016 Independent Spirit Producers Award, she has produced such festival feature favorites as the 2014 Sundance hit The One I Love, Clea DuVall's debut The Intervention, Lynn Shelton's Outside In, Miguel Arteta's Duck Butter, and Jeff Baena's Horse Girl, starring Alison Brie. And we can see a lot of those on Netflix, is that correct?
Yes, almost yes. All of those.
So, I mean, it's great quarantine viewing.
Yeah, exactly.
and Sydney Fleischman is a film and television producer living in Los Angeles, California. She has worked on films including The Overnight, Blue Jay, and Asperger's Are Us, and the acclaimed HBO television series Togetherness. She is currently an executive producer and director in HBO's Room 104, which will premiere its fourth and final season in July. I think it's here. It's here when this yeah. airs. It's here. It's already there.
Hopefully they're watching it right now.
Yes. Yeah. And Sydney is originally from Lexington, Massachusetts. A masshole. Is that what they call you guys?
I am a masshole. And I'm actually in Massachusetts right now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. My husband and I drove across the country and we are now quarantining in Massachusetts.
There are worse places to quarantine, I'd say.
Definitely.
It's the first time I've heard you call your husband. I got very excited.
Well, it's funny, he and I were talking I will obviously you're going to introduce the movie, but he and I were talking about an experience we've had with this movie and its filming locations.
Please make sure that you share some of those things with us when we talk about it. So Mel and Sid, you guys joined together, teamed up to choose the movie to talk about today, and you chose Beetlejuice. Can you give us a little explanation on why it's one of your fave genre films?
Well, it was hard because we had to both agree on a movie. And I think we both come from different ends and there was a bit of overlap. And I think we were able to agree on two things. It was like, we love everything Twin Peaks and we love Beetlejuice. And so mm-hmm. Beetlejuice made the cut.
Is that it's funny that that's sort of our Venn diagram yeah. of genre and action is Beetlejuice and Twin Peaks.
Well, I mean, you have to find your common ground.
Exactly. I mean, this is a movie that I don't even remember the first time I saw it. I was definitely young, and it definitely scared the crap out of me. But it was also just so visually stimulating and exciting and fun. And it has, to me, it has sort of like all of the things that I like in a movie, the sort of social commentary, which, I mean, obviously I did not get that as a child, but now upon recent viewings, I get.
There's a lot there to unpack.
Kind of,
it was, I saw it at such a young age, because it came out when I was 5, I think. And I just remember it being so scary and exciting. But what made it okay was that Mr. Mom, also an outdated movie, was playing Beetlejuice. So that was, I just remember being like, oh, the guy who played Mr. Mom in my other favorite childhood movie is playing the scary guy, and it's okay.
It was definitely a very big career move for him when he took that role, and we'll talk about that later too, just like the risks that you're making. But taking Beetlejuice on was not exactly like the most commercial thing for like a handsome young comic actor.
It was ballsy.
For those of you who haven't seen Beetlejuice, today's episode will obviously give you some spoilers that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch Beetlejuice first, this is your shot. And now that you're back, let me introduce Beetlejuice with a quick synopsis. Written by Michael McDowell and Warren Scarron and directed by Tim Burton for release in 1988, Beetlejuice stars Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin as perfect newlyweds Barbara and Adam in idyllic Vermont. They die tragically and then go home to realize that they are ghosts who cannot leave their house, lest they get devoured by sandworms.
Handbook for the recently diseased.
Deceased.
Deceased.
I don't know where it came from. Look at the publisher.
Handbook for the recently deceased press.
You know what? I don't think we survived the crash.
The house is immediately sold to the Dietz family, consisting of hysterical sculptor Delia.
This is my art, and it is dangerous! You think I want to die like this?
Short on nerves Charles.
I'm here to relax and clip coupons. And damn it, I mean to do it.
And their goth teen daughter Lydia.
I could live here.
Delia quickly begins transforming the house into a modern meets Bauhaus monstrosity, driving Barbara and Adam mad. So the ghosts consult their handbook for the recently deceased and visit the underworld to meet with their harried caseworker.
The Dietzes. Okay, have you been studying the manual?
Well, we tried.
The intermediate interface chapter on haunting says it all. Get them out yourselves. It's your house.
Unfortunately, they have to stay in the house for 125 years. So they try to scare the new occupants out. Sadly, they fail miserably at being scary. Lydia then finds the ghost handbook, and when they return from the underworld, she can see and speak to them.
You know, if I had seen a ghost at your age, I would have been scared out of my wits. You're not gross. Why are you wearing sheets?
We're practicing.
You can see us without the sheets.
Of course I can see you.
Well, how is it that you see us and nobody else can?
Well, I read through that handbook for the recently deceased. It says, live people ignore the strange and unusual. I myself am strange and unusual.
And she wants to help them terrify her parents. The ghosts have one last resort, one they've been warned against, summoning Beetlejuice, a bio-exorcist who specializes in scaring away humans. They summon him by saying his name 3 times, and he is an immediate, lewd, and lecherous nightmare.
You know what's really beautiful about this? You two kids picked me. You didn't have to, but you picked me. It makes me want to kiss you guys. Come on.
The ghosts decide not to go with him and try to ruin the Dietz's family dinner party by possessing them and making them dance to Deo. But the Dietz only grow more intrigued with that, and they're not scared. Charles pitches the Vermont town as a tourism hotspot for paranormal activity, and their friend Otto performs what he thinks is a summoning spell, but it's actually an exorcism, and Barbara and Adam begin rapidly decaying before Lydia's eyes.
They're dying!
Oh, they're already dead. They can't feel a thing.
That's not true! Look at them!
That's enough now. Can you stop this?
Otho, it's too late, Charles.
Sorry.
Lydia calls Beetlejuice for help and he agrees, so long as Lydia becomes his undead bride. Beetlejuice disposes of the Deets, and then the Maitlands save Lydia from a ghastly marriage and send Beetlejuice back to the underworld. Time passes, and we see the living and the dead have found a way to cohabitate in the house peacefully, and everyone is happy, even Beetlejuice, who, despite it all, is a ray of positivity. That's the movie.
What a pitch if you heard that.
I think something that I was realizing when I was writing out the synopsis is that the structure of this is very... God, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it's really strange. I mean, to have the two main characters die within the first 10 minutes, and then you don't meet the title character until 25 minutes in.
Yeah.
It doesn't really make any sense on the page, but somehow just works perfectly on the screen.
And I think that that was also, you know, part of the risk of this movie and one of the reasons why people really enjoyed it. But can you imagine pitching that in that structure of just like, there's no hero's journey, there's nothing. Like, what do you do with this?
A clear what the lead characters want, which is to get the Deetses out of their house. But yeah, it's a bonkers journey.
Yeah, I mean, listening to you summarize it, I don't know what the log line is, or at least a log line that fully captures the bizarre range that the movie covers.
Yeah, nothing could capture Beetlejuice in one sentence.
But I think that we should note that Tim Burton had done the Pee-wee movie before this. And that was kind of enough for a studio to be like, well, let's see what he does with this movie. And the way that Tim Burton had gone about it was that he was very interested in the beginning of his career, just wanting to push every person's buttons because he was just like out of animation and, you know, he just wanted to do something different and like hated like the kind of Disney staid kind of thing that he was in. But he said, quote, and this is right after the movie came out, quote, "I've been enjoying the bad reviews. These bland newscasters, they have to say the word Beetlejuice and they have to show a clip. And I don't care what anybody says. It makes me want to see the movie. It's really funny. It's like you're watching some hallucination, like somebody's putting something else behind them that they don't know about. It was like the feeling I got when I saw Andy Warhol on The Love Boat," end quote.
Oh my God. I love him so much.
It's amazing. Well, I know he grew up in Burbank, and Burbank is like such a strange moment in time. If anyone's ever been there, it has like brand new Targets next to like really old, like donut shops. And it just has this like very strange vibe to it. And so I know like in his experience, he like really bumped up against that like idyllic suburb.
Yeah, the
thing.
Suburbia.
And you can
theme.
Like really feel it in Beetlejuice, that like the pushback that he has.
Yeah. Yeah, it is crazy. I've heard that too, that he, you know, he was early in his career and he was looking for something weird, you know, or imaginative. And, you know, and that speaks so much to, I think, the way we work as filmmakers and writers and directors too, within Duplass Land. But I think Sid and I, you know, separately too, is just like that one like beautiful gem of weirdness. Like we can hang like a whole entire episode on that, you know, which really feels like, you know, kind of what he was doing with this. And I think what's always been interesting to me is because I know that it started as a darker film, if I recall. And he kind of did his like Burtonizing of it or whatever, which is what I've always loved, because there's this like underlying like dread and excitement, but then it's like, okay. And it's telling you like all these outsiders have a place, and like, it's like it lives in this like zone of weirdness that is so comforting and exciting.
Well, I think that's the thing, is it's like Beetlejuice is really like, the character is terrifying, he's disgusting, but it is a really fun movie. Like there's just so much that's like visually interesting, and there are so many amazing lines. Like Catherine O'Hara just has like amazing line after amazing line. So it's this like creepy story. I mean, about like there's an exorcism in it. They're like trying to scare people out of the house. So it's like a haunted house story disguised in this like very strange, funny package.
Yeah. I mean, do you guys Do you have discussions at all in terms of whether it's Duplass world or outside of it in your own separate spheres of how dark you can go with something before it becomes just unwatchable?
God, probably not as much as we should, maybe. I mean, I think we can go pretty dark.
I think to me, as long as it has like something grounding it, whether it's like an emotional core or there's like something funny about it, as long as those things are like keeping it sort of like tethered down to the ground, then you can kind of go as dark as you want. Which, but I think it has to have that like human connectivity thing.
No, absolutely. Which I think is what ultimately warms my heart by the end of Beetlejuice, because it is such this like story of a home, like I think you said, the coexisting or what, you know, of the living in the undead. It's such a beautiful, like, I remember watching that as a kid and being like, oh my God, that's what a true family and a home can look like. It's just this like love of, you know, coming together. And I think I think you're right, Sid. I think there is, if there's that grounding, as long as you find your footing somewhere, I think you can really go to some dark depths. As long as the rope is attached to something so you can climb back up when you need to.
I wanted to get into something real quick about Larry Wilson, who was the original kind of co-writer. He got a story by credit for this, and he was an executive before that. But he talked about how he got into screenwriting. And I think that it's worth thinking about in terms of what you guys do. He said, quote, I'd been a screenwriter, but I was also working at Paramount as a story analyst. I suffered a real case of writer's block, and I had a chance to audition to become a studio executive for Jeff Katzenberg and Michael Eisner. I saw that as a sort of doorway out of screenwriting, which I was feeling very up in the air about and wondering if I could really do it. And I became a studio executive for a couple of years at Paramount, and then I went to work for Walter Hill, the great director Walter Hill, as his head of development, and there were a series of incidents that made me realize then that I was actually giving away my best ideas and giving away my talent in a way that I was no longer comfortable with, end quote. I mean, can you guys relate to something like that? Where it's just like, you're giving away your best ideas to other people's projects all the time. Like, and at some point in time, you have to save them for yourself, right?
Sid, you go.
It's a funny thing. I don't consider myself a writer. And I think that I've tried it, and I feel like for me, like, writer's block is like as far as I go. Mm-hmm. That's just like all I am. If I was a writer, it would just be writer's block. And I think there is this strange thing in the world that we work in of like picking a lane and sticking with it. And I think for me, I've like given myself that label of producer, and I tried to do this season of Room 104, I directed an episode, and it was just like an eye-opening experience of like, oh, this is what this other role is like. This is what it actually feels to do this. And I guess as a producer, I never feel like I'm giving away my ideas. I always feel like it's for the benefit of the project. And I guess that's just validation that I am a producer and not a writer.
I would disagree, because I think you are also a writer, and you should give yourself more credit. I'm in an interesting position, because I am sort of weirdly, that whole quote was like, I'm like, oh, you're mapping my life and my trajectory, and that's freaking me out a little bit. as much as I love running Duplass Brothers, but it is, you know, it's funny, because especially with our showroom 104, me stepping into writing and directing really came from, I never meant to run a company. I never even meant to produce. And I just, you know, made myself available to a lot of things. And then, you know, you find crazy paths. And I ended up in this position where I am, like, my job has largely been for the last 10 years to make other people's dreams come true and to creatively support that, which is very rewarding. But there is like the little person on my shoulder going, but you had other things you were going to do. And so there is, like, Room 104 has become this way for me to say, okay, I am running this company, and I'm making all these things happen. And I don't feel like I'm giving myself away, because the title of producer is a very, you know, like a title that I think all of us should be very proud to have, because mm-hmm. we know what goes into that. But 104 became my outlet, you know, while running the company, to be able to be like, I'm going to go write a crazy episode and go direct it, and be able to be like, I have preserved some of this that's just for me, you know, to make my own thing. And so I think it's really been about navigating that, the balance of like all the lanes I'm trying to be straddle all at the same time, which, you know, I guess sometimes I do think about what Sid said and I'm like, maybe I should just find one lane, because that also sounds really nice and maybe a little bit less, I could be less tired.
Yeah. It's simpler being in one lane, I think. Or one lane and then sort of dabbling.
Yeah,
in
sticking
one.
Your toe every once in a while over in some other water.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more Beetlejuice and also Mel and Sid's own projects. We'll be right back. Hey, it's your host, April, and I'm here to talk about the Max Fun Drive, which has been ongoing for a couple of weeks now. And I'm also joined today by Casey, who's in... Casey, where are you? What is that?
April, I'm in my panic room because I'm getting a little pissed off. I've been stabbed. I've been beaten over the head. And I'm just sick of it. So I'm...
Yeah, you have. Yep.
So I'm in my panic room just to make sure that no one attacks me anymore, especially because my Fabergé egg was already stolen, so I don't even know what's going on anymore.
All over a Fabergé egg?
All over a Fabergé egg. I have it down to a few people. I still don't know who it is, but I think it's either my ex-wife's nephew, my stepbrother, the caretaker at Nana's house, or, of course, Drea Clark of the Who Shot You podcast. So I've kind of narrowed it down to those people.
Oh, my God.
But... that's not why I wanted to talk to you today. I wanted to talk to you about the Max Fun Drive that's still going on. It's the most exciting time of year. It just kind of shows how awesome our community is and how awesome our listeners, the Switchblade Sisters, are. I know all of our listeners are always telling their friends about our show. They're contributing and becoming members to support our show. And it's really like the community. I know this sounds sort of trite, but we literally cannot survive without our members and the people that support us. So we're just so thankful for those folks.
It's not trite. It's facts.
I was nodding enthusiastically, but I was agreeing.
Yeah. I mean, you guys can't see, but he's definitely enthusiastic.
Yes, from my panic room. April, do you want to go over how to be a member, how to join, how to support this show?
Yeah, I do. I do. Because it's actually pretty easy. All you have to do is go to MaximumFun.org/join. And there you can choose the membership level that is good for you. Because you can do $5 a month. And for that, you get bonus content and a bunch of like hours, so many hours, hundreds of hours of all of this stuff to listen to from all of our shows, including our episode where we go through a Murder, She Wrote episode that is very close to me with some wonderful pals. And some people are able to give $10 a month or, you know, $35. Some people even give $50 or $100 a month. But it's most important that you just, you know, you look at your budget and you can give what's comfortable for you. And we think that, you know, you'll like being a member and we want you to stick around. So we want to give you things. We want to, you know, make it worthwhile for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I know some of those bigger numbers might sound a little daunting, but honestly, the most important one is $5 a month. If you can just support us $5 a month, that like really helps April and I continue to make this show because this show takes a lot of time to put together, you know. Editing it and booking the guests on my side. And April, you do so much research on this show. It's insane.
It takes up a lot of my life. I'm happy to do it. And I hope that, you know, we inspire a lot of our listeners who maybe want to be filmmakers or maybe want to understand film better or just want to, you know, do their part and try to get more into women filmmakers that may have slipped through their grasp, you know, over the years. And, you know, one of the cool things, too, that we did a pin this year. We designed our own pin.
Yes.
And if you donate at the $10 a month level, it's good news because you can choose our very cool pin, which you guys should go to the website, MaximumFun.org/join, and take a look at the pins that are available, but definitely choose ours. And then at that level, if you're donating, if you're giving $10 a month, then you have the option also to purchase additional pins from the store. And all of those proceeds of the additional pins go to charity. And there's, you know, again, so many great ones to choose, but ours might be the best this year. So I'm very excited.
It is the best. So yeah, this is a special thing they're doing this week for members. If you're giving $10 a month or above, you can purchase additional pins, and those will from the ones that you already got as a prize, you can purchase more, and those proceeds will go to charity. So that's just a cool thing we're doing this week, so make sure you get on that. And yeah, I guess I just want to close this out by saying, like, we're just so thankful for our listeners and for the people that have supported us. And, you know, like, we were at Fantastic Fest last year, and there were so many awesome people that came up to us and talked to us about the show. And it's just a really special community that we want to help grow and continue to foster. So just thank you to everyone who is a part of it.
Yeah, our hearts have exploded.
That's correct. Well, April, I'm going to go, you know, I'm just trying to stay busy in my panic room, but wait, what is
it? Some poor thing.
April, someone's I can hear someone unlocking the door outside of my panic room. I don't even know I didn't even give
the... Who has the key to your panic room?
I don't know. I'm just frustrated and pissed off. Oh, it's you. Oh, my God. I can't believe it. I told you I don't have the Fabergé.
Casey. Oh, my God. Casey's been strangled. Oh, well, you have to tune in next week to see what happens with Casey and his Fabergé egg drama. And now back to the show. Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Mel Eslin and Sydney Fleischman, and we are talking Beetlejuice. So Michael Keaton, we mentioned kind of briefly at the top, and I'd like to get a little bit into how he made this. Because, again, he doesn't show up until very late in the movie, and yet he kind of steals everything as he's meant to do. But he had originally turned the role down because he was getting, you know, he just didn't understand it. And also he was just kind of bored with everything at that time. He said, quote, "I turned down the role because I didn't quite get it and I wasn't looking to work. In the original script, Beetlejuice was underwritten, vaguely Middle Eastern and more evil. But I went home and thought, okay, if I would do this role, how would I do it? You clearly don't create him from the inside out, meaning what motivates this guy, his childhood, or whatever. You work from the outside in. It turns out the character creates his own reality. So I gave myself some sort of voice, some sort of look based on the words. Then I started thinking about my hair. I wanted my hair to stand out like I was wired and plugged in. And once I started getting that, I actually made myself laugh. And I thought, well, this is a good sign. This is kind of funny. Then I got the attitude. And once I got the basic attitude, it really started to roll." End quote. So he created that entire character, which I find fascinating. I mean, I think every writer and director tries to go to the actors with a very complete character. You know, this is what they are. They're on the page. You know exactly what this is. We have a look for them. But this was a very opposite process. And the actor was allowed to essentially kind of make what Beetlejuice is. And then, you know, Tim Burton just kind of rolled with it. And I'm not sure that that's typical for a movie with this budget necessarily. But do you guys feel like you would prefer to work in that way? Having the actors kind of create things from a very vague description, or?
I think it depends. I think so much of it's, I don't know, it's easy to sort of generalize when you're talking about filmmaking, but so much of it is about the specific relationships and how the director connects with the actor or how the different actors connect with each other. And I think that there are certain situations where that, like, having the actor be a full-on creative collaborator navigating who the character is and what they're doing and all of that, where that going down that path together really makes a lot of sense. And I think there are other times when it doesn't make as much sense. And certain actors want, like, it's like, give me as much information as you can as the writer or the director about who this person is. And then I will sort of, like, we'll meet in the middle of, like, what that looks like.
Yeah, give me the mold and I just want to fit into it, basically.
Yeah. And I think that that's just the creative process for different people. I think some people like the space to explore, and other people, I mean, especially, like, I don't know, I'm thinking about, like, projects that move so fast. And I think, like, with Room 104, there are definitely actors who come in and they're like, I want all the space to play. And then there are people who are like, I'm only here for a short amount of time. Like, let's be really specific and deliberate about how we're going to do this together. And so it's just, I think it really depends on the specific individuals.
Yeah. Something that I found very interesting too, is the fact that, like, the kind of improvisation of Michael Keaton didn't stop when they got to set. I mean, he was encouraged to go wild. He said, quote, "At some point, you show up on the set and just go fucking nuts. It was rage acting. You rage for 12 or 14 hours, then you go home tired and beat and exhausted. It was pretty damn cathartic."
Wow, you totally see that in that, what is the rant he does where they're like, what are your qualifications? And he starts with, like,
oh my God,
Harvard,
yeah,
educated, and next thing you know, he's like seen The Exorcist like 600 whatever times.
What are your qualifications?
Ah, well, I attended Juilliard. I'm a graduate of the Harvard Business School. I travel quite extensively. I lived through the Black Plague, and I had a pretty good time during that. I've seen The Exorcist about 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every single time I see it! Not to mention the fact that you're talking to a dead guy! Now what do you think?
I mean, there is, like, there's such an energy in that, and it does feel like he's like, I'm here to fuck shit up, balls to the walls. But then he can be so controlled in other moments. It is, I mean, it's making me realize too, from a very early age, that was the example I was given as far as this is what you can do with art, and just, like, take it and make it your own in such a beautiful, fucked up, wild way.
Yeah. And he operates, I mean, Tim Burton operates in this, like, when his movies really work, he operates in this, like, amazing space between reality and fantasy, where it's, like, not really either, but also kind of both. And, like, to be able to balance those things and, like, balance all of the, like, the light and the darkness and everything that's sort of at play, it's such a hard balancing act to, like, find the through line between all of those things. And to me, this movie is just, like, the perfect example of, like, something that's just so morbid and dark being, like, really palatable and just visual, like, so interesting. I mean, like, all of the, like, the sandworms and all of the models, it's so arts and craftsy. It's just, like, it's like what you were saying, Mella, how it's, like, a little bit messy, but in a way that just makes it, like, that much more accessible.
Yeah, it does feel that there's a commitment behind it. And I think that's what, you know, even when I look at the CGI, it is messy and it's not great, but it almost, everything feels like it has purpose and intention in a way that I can get behind it. You know, it's, and I think that's the big thing, is when you go wild and you go crazy, like, as long as you have a sense of the intention, which maybe he didn't, if they all showed up and said and didn't know what was going on. So this is, like, throwing all my thoughts out the window, maybe. But it does feel, everything in this feels so intentional. Even down to, like, this is a very dark movie full of so many colors and just, like, visually everything, you know. Like, I think, you know, as a kid when I was watching it, trying to, like, understand what it all meant, and now I watch it and I'm like, no, this all checks for me. this all drives. I don't know.
You know, there's two different sensibilities too that are working on this. Warren Skerrin was well, he's passed now, but he was the writer hired to do the rewrite of this. And there's a whole story of that, of him being, you know, essentially one of the most respectful rewriters of scripts in Hollywood. Everyone was just like, oh, like, if he's hired, it's totally fine. Like, he'll get my vision and, you know, like, he'll just bring it out, like, all the best parts. But So Michael McDowell was coming from a place where he was kind of obsessed with Chinese and Japanese occult films. And those kind of shaped his sensibility, specifically for the terms of how the supernatural was treated in a very straightforward fashion. And also he was very interested in poking fun at Americans and their kind of fear of death. He actually wrote a thesis for his graduate degree, I think, called American Attitudes Towards Death. Then Warren Skerrin, the way that he had looked at it was that he was trying to craft a character in Beetlejuice who would receive fan letters. And he ended up, like, this fictional character did end up receiving mountains of fan letters. And so both of them, I think, succeeded, but they were kind of working at opposite ends of trying to make this story workable. And I think, you know, you've got someone who's coming from a more commercial aspect of, like, yeah, you have to kind of like this character. You can't, like, they can't be hated. Like, yeah. They have to be some kind of, like, cad or something. But, I mean, how do you deal with, like, unlikable characters? I mean, what do you do? How do you make them receive a fan letter?
That's God. Such a funny way of thinking about
it. I know. It's...
I think they just have to be going through something. I mean, I don't know if... I feel like... the characters that we have, especially on Room 104, are very different from Beetlejuice. Like, I remember as a kid, like, being scared and repulsed by him, but also, like, so engaged. And, like, I loved him and hated him. Mm-hmm. And that's such a weird, like, he's disgusting. He's just, like, he's got, like, mold on his face. He's so gross. And you're still...
I feel like you can smell, like, that mold, too, through the yes. screen. Like, mm-hmm. it is... But I think you're, it's comedy, though. I really do think it's comedy. Because I think about it in the way, even when I watch Succession, which I love that show, and I'm like, I hate all of you, but you're so funny. So I'm in. Like, I love it. Like, I'm in love with all of them because they're funny. Is that it?
Yeah, it's
like, you can forgive a lot of things if they can tell a good joke or a good story or something.
Maybe that's not a universal way to move through life, but...
It's not a good way to date.
Yeah, sure. But we've all done it.
It's also such a hard thing to pull off because you can have somebody who's just so, so terrible and maybe they're funny, but you're like, they're just terrible. I can't see past that. But I don't know. It's like a charm. I think to me, so many of the people on Succession, it's like they're awful and they're just like greedy, backstabby people, but like they are weirdly charming. And Beetlejuice is really charming.
Mm-hmm.
Except when he like grabs there. Oh my, I forgot how many grabs.
Oh, yeah, no, he's horrible.
Inappropriate grabs there are in this movie. It's crazy.
Oh, he, in like the first like minute he's on screen, he looks up Gina Davis's skirt.
Yeah.
Like he's just, he's gross.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's disgusting. But he's so funny.
He's so funny.
And he does have like this, he does have weirdly human desires that I think, I mean, as fucked up as him wanting to marry Lydia is, because I think she's like 15 in the movie. Like mm-hmm. that totally went over my head as a kid. But there is something about being like, oh, he just wants a partner that I'm like, I gotta give it to him. Like, we all just want a partner in crime through life, right?
Oh, wow. Now you're just really forgiving him for a lot. We talked a little bit about music earlier, but specifically we were talking about the score. And I wanted to get into the fact that the Harry Belafonte's Deo became a huge hit again.
Yeah.
Because of this. You know, according to Marjorie Lewis, who was a producer on it and who was kind of like the key in helping get this movie made, she was saying that when it came to the song that they were going to sing, it became so, so difficult because they wanted to do the R&B classic When a Man Loves a Woman, pre-Michael Bolton, and everything was too expensive, and they kept throwing more and more songs out, and everything was too expensive. And she said, quote, "Every time somebody heard the words David Geffen, they raised the price," end quote. Because Geffen was like the person who ended up buying and, you know, making this movie. And so the second that they knew that his name was attached to it, they were like, oh, we would like this much more. And so the one song that they could actually like afford for the budget ended up being Belafonte's Deo, and, you know, randomly turned into probably one of the better scenes of the film, I think, because of that song. Amazing.
It's definitely one of the most memorable. I mean, to have that song, and it goes on for so long.
Yes.
It's not just like a couple of seconds of it. It's like, we're gonna dance for a while. But I think one of my favorite things about this movie and other Tim Burton movies is the like timelessness of it. Mm-hmm. And I think if there had been a song that was more of the time, or like any pop music used throughout the movie instead of the Danny Elfman score, mm-hmm. if there had been any hint of that, it would just have such a weird, it would be really dated and it would just feel really strange. And I think that the Maitlands being sort of in this like 50s perfect relationship, there's like, it makes sense that it's an older song that doesn't fit the time and is just like, it's a timeless.
And it also feels like the, like when Catherine O'Hara first opens her mouth, it feels like she's so embarrassed. Like it's a song that yuppies would be so embarrassed to be singing and dancing to, which I think is so perfect. And if you watch that scene, I think that is one of the most phenomenally acted scenes by everybody. And I mean, like, they are lip syncing, dancing, like in sync.
And fighting it.
And it's like comedy. I mean, it is. I love that scene so much. Even just like turning the volume off and watching what they're all doing with their bodies, it is such an amazing feat being able to pull that all off and orchestrate that.
So I wanted to also get into special effects. You guys have been dealing with quite a few, I would say, special effects on 104. And, you know, from ranging from the big to the small. But this was kind of another level of special effects in a time when actors still weren't quite used to it, specifically like these actors. Gina Davis probably had like the most experience of anyone, though.
Oh, yeah.
Alec Baldwin, however, said, quote, "It's difficult insofar as you really have to use your imagination to imagine things that aren't in the shot at the time. Let's say," he'll say, "at this point, the four-headed reptile is rearing up to bite you and you have to react to it. You don't see anything. The other part is you have to do it many times. It's a movie where you have to do a lot of takes, not performance-wise, but technically a lot of takes to get everything just right," end quote. And I think that became the kind of frustrating thing for the actors on set, and a credit to them that they were able to keep it together for so many takes and still deliver lines with great energy. Because at some point in time after you've said them, it's really hard to get like shocked again for the four-headed reptile that's rearing up to get you that you don't see. I feel like we've gotten to the point in special effects where we don't have to do as many takes. Like, we can get things right a little bit faster. But I'm curious about kind of your experience in terms of like trying to keep the actor's energy up, even though it's just like, well, you have to reset because the special effect, we need to get this correct, or the timing of this, or like the framing, and, you know, how to work that.
God, yeah, it's so hard. It's so hard to just get that organic reaction, I think, period, even on the first take when they're having to navigate, whether they're talking to a C-stand or, you know, like on a rig and having to land in a perfect spot, you know. And or I think in one episode, didn't we have like a head that had to prop up on a C-stand uncomfortably? It's just like
oh my God. Yeah. We had somebody she had to rest her chin on a tennis ball. And I just felt so bad because it was an uncomfortable scene just in terms of where the character was and the performance. And then for her to be physically uncomfortable was just, I mean, maybe that added to her, maybe that helped in some ways, but I think it must just be so challenging as an actor to have to navigate that. And they're already using their imaginations. And then it's like an extra layer of it.
Yeah. I mean, thankfully we have like, you know, special effects have come a long way. And I think also there's a little bit of, you just have to be loose with it. I have definitely found myself, you know, after like three or four takes of asking an actress to go wow to something that's in the toilet that's not there, you know, just being like, you, like, I'm not going to be as precious because I know what I'm asking them to do. And it's like, you know what? I got 3 alt takes. We're going to make this work. You know, and effects is usually the one running over being like, but you didn't get exactly them looking at this point. And I'm like, it's fine. Like, I'm going to embrace a little bit of this messiness to, you know, have more of the organic reaction. You know, so it's a balancing act of, you know, of figuring out what you're going to prioritize, you know? I mean, thankfully we're not creating like whole worlds. Like this isn't like the new Blade Runner or something where like we have to be so technical. You know, I'm sure my tune will change in that regard.
Yeah. Once you do a new Blade Runner.
Exactly. When I do the next Blade Runner, I'll
feel Mel's making an announcement.
You've heard it here first.
Yeah. I mean, we work with this VFX company for Room 104 called Barnstorm, and they have the same attitude as us on set, where it's like, we're going to prepare as much as we can. And then once we get in it, we're just going to have to figure things out. And they're just so, they're so flexible with us, which I feel very thankful for that. They make the actors' lives easier too.
Yeah. No, and that is what the best filmmaking is you just come to the table so prepared that you can keep moving when all the unexpected gets thrown at you, which it will, and you're never going to do it the way you planned. And so you just
we know what we're doing and we don't know what we're doing.
You know what's important to you, and then you just try and keep getting that as much as possible and then being okay when you don't.
Yeah. And, you know, we didn't talk anything about the set design, but I think that we should just at least cover that because Beau Welch, who designed the sets, you know, obviously a fantastic artist. He described the sets as, quote, a hierarchy of reality that leads you into unreality. Tim would encourage me to push that border. I'd go a certain distance and he'd say, let's go further. And I'd go, ah. And then be thrilled when we did it, end quote. And that's the kind of collaboration that he has too, is just kind of saying, can you do more, challenging his crew and his cast to kind of to pull out all of their greatest tricks, you know?
God, what a balance though, because I do think there's times where you can push people too far and then they are sort of like self-destruct. So it's like, I love that idea though, of being like, go further than the end of your line. But knowing when you're like, okay, you're too far. I got you. Come back. It's like, and having somebody have that trust in you to like, let them push you out past your comfort zone. That's amazing. I love that. We all need to do that more probably.
Well, I mean, when you're pressed for time, when you're pressed for budget, I think it's kind of hard to sometimes ask your crew to go further, to do more. And, you know, you hope that everyone's kind of in the same boat and they all want to do their best work for this, no matter like how much they're getting paid or who's going to see it. And but I still think it's kind of an art to ask that of people, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, we talk about it a lot on Room 104 because the whole premise of the show is limitations and restrictions. It's the four walls of the room. It's the budget. It's the time that we have to shoot each episode. And for me, I think obviously having that, like the mutual trust with our crew, it just allows us to be wildly creative and super imaginative. And that really feels like the one resource that we have an unlimited amount of. It's like, if we all put our heads together and everybody is willing to go that sort of extra mile to make it as wild as we want it to be, it really pays off.
But you have to feed them really well too.
Yeah.
But I think it is, I'm so glad you brought that up because I think we can all as filmmakers and, you know, as television producers get in such a habit of talking about the creative within this tiny bubble of the writer, director, the actors. And it is, as we all know, filmmaking is such a bigger collaboration. And I do think it is, I love it when we're shooting a scene. And again, it's like having that confidence and trust in your collaborators, but also the self, you know, reliance to be able to listen to other people's ideas. But I've had it where like the boom operator is holding the boom and suddenly comes in and is like, you know what, I've been watching this scene and this thing should happen. And having this like creative collaboration that can happen is so beautiful when you hit the right tone and you have the right people involved. But you know, even on like the bigger sets, like I think with Room 104, and I, you know, I've done this on a lot of the movies, but when you are pressed for time or you've pushed everybody and you've got like, you just want that one take, you know, walking around and talking to everybody that you can and being like, this is what I want. And having like a dialogue with the whole team is such a beautiful thing that I've experienced other directors do. And I've done myself as a producer, and it's been such this great way to, you know, and if somebody pushes back, maybe stop and listen and be like, do you really need this? Cause somebody's pushing back on it. Mm-hmm. You know, I get that's putting a lot of trust into your whole team and crew, which is, you know, can be tough, but you know, I think it's interesting to have that dialogue with everybody involved when you can.
Well, that's a great place for us to wrap up. Trust your cast and crew. Thank you guys so much for joining me today to talk about Beetlejuice and remind people they can watch Room 104 on HBO, right?
Yes.
And where else can they see your work?
Netflix. Everything's on Netflix. I feel like everything's on Amazon too these days, right? But Netflix and HBO.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. HBO Max.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. There's another one.
Oh, right. Right.
All the HBOs.
Open up any one of your apps and I'm hoping you'll find something.
I think they will. And thank you for listening to our show. And thank you so much if you are if you've become a supporting member of the show. We're truly, truly, truly grateful for anything that you've been able to contribute financially to support us. Again, we are a show that is listener supported, and we have a great deal of creative freedom because of that. And so you'll notice that the format of our show, the way that we do it, it's hard to describe. It's different. You're not going to see another show like it. And that's because, you know, you've given us the blessing by supporting us financially or by telling your friends to listen to us. And we just cannot be more grateful for all that you do for us. So if you haven't had a chance to become a member, though, you can do so at MaximumFun.org/join. And again, thank you. And we love you so much. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group too. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our associate producer for this episode is Jordan Cowling. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
This is my art and it is dangerous. You think I want to die like this?
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.